When you golf in Missouri, the courses are so close, you'll spend more time on the fairway than the freeway. Reserve a tee time at the Regal Osage National, designed by the king himself, Arnold Palmer. Take a cart ride on the wild side in the breathtaking surrounds of Payne's Valley, designed by Tiger Woods. And after the back nine, there's still world-class dining and distilleries, shops and spas, museums and more. Find your new golf MO in Missouri. Start planning your golf getaway at visitmo.com.
You're so wild.
She's a wild and crazy
girl. She's wild.
We had so much fun last night. I had fun last night at the dance party with children. That ruled.
Yeah, it's my favorite thing to do. I absolutely love going over there and partying.
I mean, it's worth it. I think
I actually have some videos to show you from the last time we were there and the kids were dancing, and it was the cutest thing I've ever seen in my life. Like, it is my favorite. It was kids' dance parties. You cannot beat that.
You can't, because I actually was like, I really should have like left the house today, and then we went to dinner, and then I'm glad I left the house. And more importantly, I was like, oh, I got to dance and sweat a little. Incredible. Yeah. The best was that we were at our friend, we were at Rozzy's house, and her daughter Zena just like knew it was time and got up. And I can't describe like how beautiful it is to see a kid just like live in her body and like not make no apologies to.
Zena's the best dancer of anyone I know. Like, and she is my favorite person to dance with.
Cause she, and she's
no
so,
holds barred. She
no,
like
she's
throws
so
all in.
In it. You know what? Who also is like fully in fourth gear, locked in.
Griffin.
You know who I'm gonna. Yeah.
Yeah. He makes the craziest faces I've ever seen.
You know, it feels like he's releasing some energy that feels good that he's releasing.
He makes like these faces, like.
It's really. His fate, like, and again, it's such a testament. I love being around kids because you're like, nobody here is self-conscious. Like, nobody here is like, oh no, will somebody see me do something crazy? They just get to like fully go for it. Fucking incredible. I haven't seen you since. We haven't seen our readers since I saw you literally 2 minutes
ago. You just saw me.
I'm living in your home.
I'm in the room next door.
Yeah,
you miss me?
I do. I go, where's Quinn? I don't think we talked to the readers about Wicked and also that we're going to see Wicked. And I feel like the press tour wants us to talk about Wicked because they're spending so much money on marketing. But more importantly, Quinn and I'm going with Quinn and Koa and Brayden, and we're going to see Wicked tomorrow. And it is the first time I have ever seen a movie more than once in a theater.
And Brayden's seen it more than once.
He's seen it more. No, he has not.
He's already seen it. Yeah.
How many times has he seen it?
And it was his idea to go. And he was like, I think we should go see Wicked. And I was like, great. And then I found out afterwards, after we got tickets, he's like, well, I have gone. But I was like, what?
I'm obsessed with that. I'm really obsessed with that.
Everybody's loving this movie. So I hope it delivers.
My only warning is that there are some scary moments.
Oh, Koa's well-equipped to deal with scary moments.
Don't you love that? You're putting in the work, man. You put in the work for the scary, for the dividends, so that you're not, like, worried about what he's seeing. And I think that's pretty fucking cool.
Yeah. He's been very good at... I was not as good at watching scary stuff when I was his age. But I think... I don't know. Maybe it's because we let him sleep with us that he feels empowered.
So that's the trick. I mean, what do you think is the scariest movie Ko has ever seen? Because I actually think like he just saw Home Alone, which feels like really a big part of someone's development.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, God, that's a good question. I wonder what he would say. I mean, the truth is he's allowed to see the Harry Potter movies whenever he finishes the books. So he's seen the first like 4 or 5 movies.
He's okay, on the sixth five. Book. Okay, 5 gets scary. Like, I think 3 is scary because you have Sirius Black.
So he's seen,
like,
scenes with Death Eaters and stuff. I mean, that stuff can be very scary, but he feels equipped. He likes spoilers. He feels okay going into scary things as long as they've been spoiled.
Do we need to spoil some of Wicked for him?
No. Can I tell you something really funny? Mm-hmm. I think my friend's 4-year-old apparently has a test today, and definitely the mom found in his clothes a piece of paper that says Czech words, and she realized it's supposed to say cheat words.
I thought it was sneak words.
And he's trying to cheat on his test. He's like 4. No, he's 5. He's 5 years old. He's in kindergarten. I don't know why they're giving him a test to begin with. That's problematic. But she found in his pants, I guess, this piece of paper that's a cheat list for his spelling test, which I'm also like, I would love to see him trying to execute that in the classroom.
Yeah.
And when she took the list away, he told his mom, he's like, it doesn't matter. I'm going to write the words inside my shirt so I'll be able to look at them. She's like, you're crazy. So then she warned his teachers. She ratted him out to his teachers. And his teachers responded. They were like, oh, he tries to cheat all the time.
One. Wow. I guess blood isn't thicker than water, because that mom is ratting your kid out.
She's like, I'm ratting him.
It makes me so, I don't know how, if I should feel sad for him or also like proud of him, because at 5 years old,
he's powerful and he feels good and he feels like he's trying to figure it out. He's like, I'm going to cheat. Like, I don't want to learn these words. And I'm like, you know what? Makes sense.
It makes sense. I mean, adults cheat all the time. And, you know, they have spell check, they have calculators. Yeah. Like, I don't, you know, so. Interesting take for 5-year-old. It does make me go, I remember this one time I babysat, and this is related, I promise, but I babysat this, and I went to, it wasn't the kid I was babysitting, but I went to a bris, mm-hmm. and we get there, and this family had night nurses for their mm-hmm. children, mm-hmm. and so the baby had already been brist, and if you don't know, that's the Jewish religious ceremony of circumcision.
Penis chopping.
And so this woman was like, oof, yeah, this baby didn't cry. We're in for it. Like, she talked about how the baby, like, got his dick chopped off and didn't cry. And she was like,
I've had worse.
And she was like, that scares me. She was like, I've seen a lot of babies. If they don't cry, they're scary children. And she was like, this baby was silent. Was peaceful.
Just like dead-eyeing them?
Just dead-eyeing.
Just like, and I go ahead. Fucking do it.
I dare you. And she's like, he's like, I feel no pain. And this is an infant, right? So it's like, this baby nurse was saying that. And so I feel like she's seen some shit. And I feel like similarly, like, if you're cheating at 5, hold on to your butts, is how I feel about that. I say when you show shit like that from a young age, you're kind of like, ooh, we're dealing with a powerful thing.
Yeah. But also, like, they're still learning morality at that age. Like, I remember being like, when Ko was 4 specifically, I remember I was like, whoa, serial killer vibes. Like, definitely didn't have empathy. But, like, they're growing that muscle. And then, like, they figure it out. But, like, there's a while where they're like, they, like, look at you with bewilderment when you're having a feeling in this way that it's like, it does nothing for them.
Oh, man.
Let's think some
okay.
Blim-blams.
Let's blank some blim-blams.
We're listening to Truly.
Darkly. Creepy. Yeah. I'm Carrie Epima.
I'm Quinn. Let's sing to Tashik.
Tashik, Tashik, you are so freaking chic. We love your style because you're chic as shit. Tashik, 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 you Tashik, are.
Tashik, 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 Tashik. Oh, I was just doing backup. Oh. Sorry.
Tashik, you are such a star in our eyes. You are here to say, let's have some pie. Pie is good. Do you like fruit? Do you like chocolate pie? Or do you like, what do you like? Tashik, Tashik, you are so chic. We love you. Are you from Chicago? Because you're so chic. Tashik, Tashik, thank you for being here. Tashik, you are so dear to us.
It's clear. Let's sing to Ava. Is that it? Ava, would you be so mad? Ava, you come in, bring in the flavor of Patreon.
Fava.
It's a great taste in my mouth. It lights me on fire down in the south.
Why are you talking about tasting Ava in your mouth? That seems weird. Are you Jeffrey Dahmer? No, you are not. You are Quinlan Bleep because you're not saying your last name. Ava, Ava, thank you for bringing your flavor to Patreon. We love you so much, Ava.
You really saved us.
What is going on with your hair?
I don't know. I gotta,
you were, you put it up and then you said, let's put it right in front of my face. Are you debating getting bangs?
When I do this, do you think I should?
Do you think you'd ever... I think so. I would love, you know, bangs, we all go through it. It's, have you ever had bangs?
Of course, but I didn't have like little bangs. I had side sweeps. Does everyone do like a side sweep?
Yeah, that's like a that's bang for beginners. That's beginner bangs.
That's more bang for your buck, if you know what I mean.
I do know what you mean.
We're gonna
Thank
go
you
see
so
the
much.
Lights. It's like record lows. It's like the coldest night.
Is
of
it
the
really?
Year.
Oh shit! You know, here's what's funny, Quinn.
Bundle the fuck up.
Really?
Yeah, but here's the thing. We'll take warm breaks at FAO Shorts. We'll take the kids in there so they can shop and then we'll go to dinner. So it'll be lots of warm breaks, but that initial walk from...
If we need a warm break, I'm going
to
bring...
to Saks is going to be a brutal.
Here's the deal. As I'm bringing a pantsuit that I have to return to Anthropology. So if we need a warm break, happy to go into Anthropology to return this jumpsuit.
Great.
You know, I figure two birds, one stone. Quinn, do you feel like we have less to talk about because we're living together right now?
Yeah, it's problematic.
It's really tough for the podcast.
It's really hard because you know everything. I'm like, what did I do yesterday? A puzzle with you. Should we talk about
dinner
the 1980s
with you.
Themed puzzle we did?
Like, yeah.
We have to tell each other, like, remember when we were both in the kitchen and this happened? Like, it's so dumb.
I will say this. This is the last story I will tell. Because who knows what we're cutting out of this, but this is the last story I told. So every Wednesday, I go into my offices at Paperless Post, and I go in there for a very specific reason, and it's because they buy us lunch every Wednesday, and nothing will get my ass in a fucking office than some food. And here's the other deal, it's a startup, so like with a lot of young people, so there's like a lot of snacks everywhere, right? Mm-hmm. So I go in there and I'm like, all right, I guess I'm shopping, and I decide to take snacks home. And then I like, if there's extra. So what happened was, is there was some extra burritos there at the office because we had gotten burritos. Mm-hmm. And so I knew someone wasn't there. So I took one, and then it was like 4 o'clock and one of the burritos was like out and about on the counter. And I was like, well, I don't want these to go to waste. And I was like, and Quinn and Matt would probably love a fucking burrito. So I was like, I have to take multiple burritos. Right? That's just what common sense is. And I felt so guilty because, one, I took a backpack and I opened all the snack drawers and I took out little snacks and bars because mm-hmm. I was like, you know what? Quinn and family, like, I have to provide somehow. And luckily, no one was in there until the tail end when I had, like, my hands full of bars. And I felt like I had to acknowledge it because this woman was so nice, but she came in and I was like, oh, I think I'm taking snacks. And she's like, okay. And I was like, yeah, I'm staying with some friends. And I just start like explaining myself in a way. Like, this is how not good of a criminal I am, not good of a sneak I am. Mm-hmm. My backpack was like chock full. And I knew I had a burrito in the refrigerator, but there was a burrito out on the counter. And so I played dumb and I was like, do you think anyone's taking these burritos? And she was like, no, I mean, I took an extra one. And I was like, yeah, but I felt guilty because I was going to take two burritos, extra burritos, which means that day, Carrie took three burritos, one I ate at lunch and the two other. And so then I was like trying, it was so embarrassing because I just felt so guilty and my mouth doesn't stop and I feel like I have to explain myself. And so I like snuck a burrito from the refrigerator and then I was like, I guess I'll take this one from the counter. And I'm sure she knew and I felt so uncomfortable. And the other thing I did while I was there is that they had a dirty soda thing. Do you know what
this is? What's a dirty soda thing?
Why are you so angry when you say that? So
a dirty soda, you don't think that that's something to be angry about?
Well, because I know what it is. So basically, it was really big when the Secret Lives of Mormon Wives came out. And what it is because Mormons are not allowed to have coffee or tea. Like, they're not allowed to have caffeinated drinks. Mm-hmm. So what they do is they basically treat soda like they're like fun mix-alls. So you can have like a Diet Coke with coconut cream and like lime and a shot of vanilla or whatever it is. So like you can doctor up. Now, it's a little bit confusing because some of them use Coke or things with caffeine in it. But basically, it's like you can have a bar of soda. And so the office had like a list of, like, I guess people were curious, and the team was like, oh, here's a bunch of soda that you can mix in and we can have it at the office. I think the ingredients were pretty low by the time I got there. So I just had a can of Coke with coffee creamer, and you pour it into the Coke, and I took like a sip and I was like, this is interesting. And then I threw it out. Either way, when I'm at that office, all bets are off and I just go ape shit with free shit. And it is, it's exactly what I'm going to do, but it's also something that does cause me great shame and embarrassment.
I think that's interesting. I kind of feel like everybody is on the same page about taking free food, and nobody would ever, like, I don't think anyone would ever judge you.
Here's the thing. I work part-time, so I don't get health insurance. So
you need this to get burritos. Yeah.
Exactly right. Exactly right. I couldn't have said it better myself. Sense.
Great. All right. Cool. Just so you guys know, to like timestamp this, the killer of the United Healthcare.
Has he been caught?
Is still at large. No.
Yeah.
But I feel like he will be. So I'm timestamping it by saying he's at large.
He's at large. That was my first day back in New York. And I got to say, welcome back.
Yeah. I have a story about it, but I'm going to tell it to you on the Patreon because it's too funny to tell on the regular episode.
Okay. Sign me up.
What a bitch. All right. Let's do some stories. Who's first?
You are.
Oh, great. Okay. I'm going to tell you guys this story that is from, it's just one source because it was done hastily, but it also could only ever be one source because it's this personal story that just came out in the New York Times. It's an article by Susan Dominus, and you should just go read it. You shouldn't even listen to me tell it because I'm just kind of summarizing what she wrote.
What are you doing here? Leave. Go.
Please leave. This is personal. It takes place in a suburb in LA, and the stars of the story are Daphna Cardinal and her husband, Alexander. Daphna's a therapist. Alexander is a singer-songwriter, and they have a daughter, Olivia, who they've been wanting to give her a baby brother or sister for a long time. And they tried for a while to conceive. It wasn't working out. So then they do IVF, and it works, and they have baby May, and that's not her real name. Like, that's a protection measure. Yeah. She's a really good baby. They're so excited. They're completely in love with her. They are like, you have very dark hair for being our baby. You don't really look like us. And the dad especially is like, this baby doesn't look like me at all, or you. That's crazy. And so he'd make a lot of jokes about it and be like, I think the clinic made a mistake. And then, like, their friends and family members are like, whoa, no, that baby does look really different. That baby looks Asian. That's crazy. But you never know. Whitney, my sister, just had a baby. Her baby looked Asian. And he did not look like his either black dad or white mom. He looked like an Asian baby the first few weeks. And we were like, oh, my God, what's going on?
Babies are crazy.
And so you don't know. And then Daphna is like, I don't know. I think it's just a crazy thing because she has a picture of herself at that age that she kind of looks like the baby. So she's like, meh. And then, but her husband keeps making jokes. So she's finally like, should we just get a DNA kit? Ah, ha, ha, ha. And he's kind of like, yeah, we should maybe.
Ooh. And she uses IVF, right? So that's, okay.
Yeah. All right. They don't really think about it. They like request it and then they don't think about it. But then it gets delivered 3 weeks later and May is now 2 months old. And they take this DNA test. They they look at the DNA results that have come back, and the dad's like, whoa, I'm 99.9% not a match for the father. And the wife's like, what? And he's like, hold up.
Oh my God.
You are a 99.9% not likely match for the mother. This isn't our baby. And they're like,
oh my God. What?
And the craziest thing is they're not expecting to get this news. They have tickets to go to Frozen 2 with Olivia, and they have a sitter for the baby. And there's no way you can turn to your 5-year-old and be like, we're not going to Frozen anymore. So they have to go sit and watch Frozen 2 in a movie theater. Imagine the comatose, what the actual fuck is happening to my life. And they're like, the unsettled feeling of feeling like a kidnapper also, and being like, I have someone's baby.
This is 2 months of you having a baby.
It's their baby. Like, it's their baby. Loving it. And it's been imprinting on them.
Exactly.
So they don't know what to do. They're like, what should we do? So they get a surrogacy lawyer who deals with the clinic and opens an investigation. And they are like panicking constantly. And Olivia's like, da da da, that's my sister, May. They figure out who the parents are, and they're like, the parents of the baby you have live 10 minutes away from you, which is crazy. Yes, the dad is Asian American, the mom's Latina, so there's maybe a reason your baby doesn't super look like you. You're both white. That family that lives 10 minutes away has a 2-month-old too, and it's your baby.
No, I thought, okay, here's my reaction right now. I don't know if I should be like, it's good that they both have a baby, right? Because like, imagine one of them didn't have imagine, I just can't, that would be horrifying.
Like if the other couple's baby didn't make it or so. Yeah.
Yes. Or they, or like, it just, oh my God.
So that couple doesn't know. So then the clinic has to call them, and the fertility doctor, I guess, is crying on the phone and is like, I'm so sorry. I have to tell you something. That's not your baby. Someone has your baby. That's not your baby. And of course, that couple's been like having the same sort of experience in the sense that they have this like blue-eyed baby that doesn't look like them either. So Annie and her husband are the other couple, and their daughter is Zoe. And they live 10 minutes away, and they also have an older son and then this baby girl. And when her eyes became blue at 2 months, they were like, that's very weird. And the doctor's like, oh, yeah, it's like recessive, but you never know. It often comes out and just surprises people. When they call her and tell her that it is not her baby, her milk dries up. She can no longer nurse. It's really sad because it's so traumatic.
It's trauma, yeah.
So it's now the holidays. It's the day after Christmas. The couples have like contact via voicemails, emails, but they're going to meet. And when they meet, they like see the guy. They see Annie's husband and they're like, oh, that's our baby's face. Like, oh, they like see the, it's so odd. And the women just like fall into each other, hug each other.
Oh, thank God.
For so long and like can't let go. And the dads are like, hello, hi there, like nodding, you know, like hands in pockets.
Dude, Swain.
They're good to date. Sports, huh? Whatever. Awkward. So they immediately have this weird bond and this feeling that like, they're connected because it's so traumatic, but nobody really knows how traumatic it is except each other. There's these four people that are having this unprecedented, completely insane thing happen to them.
Right.
And so they just like, are together and they don't know what to do. And then they're like, what should we do? And basically the dads are like, we should switch babies, you guys. Like, we should have our genetic babies. It's 2 months is not a lifetime. We should do this. And they're like, how are we going to tell our kids? So like Daphne and Alexander have to tell Olivia, who's then like, I don't understand. And they're like, well, you have a sister. It's a different person. And Olivia's like, you're giving my sister away? And it's so traumatic for her and confusing.
Oh my God.
of course, they're like filing lawsuits against the clinic, and their lawyer says that he's represented more than 1,000 people that have gone against clinics for some kind of negligence. It's not no, it's not this specific always. What it usually is like accidentally losing or destroying an embryo. There was like this couple that really wanted to test the embryo to make sure a disease gene that they carried was not going to be in their kid, because it's really scary. It's like your kid will like most definitely have this cancer or something. And they told him it didn't. And then they got pregnant, and then they gave birth, and then they found out their kid was a carrier of that gene. So it's just like,
okay. Yeah. Malpractice. Yeah. There's been some
like fucked up lawsuits, and it's amazing because the technology is so great, but at the same time, they're keeping files by pen and paper. Sometimes they have like bad screening measures. They're high volume. They're not being regulated well enough. And
yeah,
the oversight is just not there. We've covered cases
where we've covered cases where we can know that some fertility clinics have taken full advantage of the lack of regulation.
That's right. So the couples go meet their babies for the first time, and it's super intense because they don't know how to be around each other's babies. Like, the babies don't want to go to the other couple, and they cry, or you pick up the baby and you're like, this doesn't feel like how my baby feels, but that is your baby. So everyone is meeting the babies. They're like giving space for that. And for just 2 weeks, that's what they do. They just meet up every day and they spend a little time. They can't do it like a fucking Band-Aid, obviously. Basically just spending time, but it's really awkward because like, say a baby poops, you go to change that baby and then you're like, oh, that's your baby. So it's this feeling of, like, oh, do you want to change your kid? I'm used to changing her because I thought she was my kid.
I think like the awkward shuffle of all that. Parenting is so personal, and everybody has their own way of doing things. And you are protective of this like little baby.
So interesting you say that, because one of the things they said that made it so much better, this whole situation, is that the couples are similar financially, non-religious, gentle parenting style. There's like all these commonalities they have that, if you could imagine if they didn't have.
Yeah.
Imagine one couple lives in a mansion and one lives in a trailer. And it's like there would be something so strange for both. Or one is like super religious. Or one is, I don't know, just like, we believe in corporal punishment. I don't know. There could be so many things that you would be like, I don't want to give this baby to you, even though it's yours. Yeah.
Like even as something as simple as like, crying it out, sleep training. Do you know what I mean? Like that could elicit such a strong, strong maternal reaction. Mm-hmm. Oh my God.
Yeah. And every time they feel happy because they're having a bonding moment with the baby they're meeting, they're also feeling sad because there's like a goodbye that's going to happen with this baby that they thought is theirs. So it's very challenging for everybody. They do an overnight for the first time, and the plan had been that they were going to do this really slowly and do an overnight and then go back and then do this. But after the first overnight, May can't stop crying. And Annie, as a mom, is like, oh my God, I can't stop this baby from crying. She doesn't know me. She's scared.
Oh.
But instead of her being like, this is scary, it kind of creates this situation where the next day they're like, we can't switch back. We have to just start living with our children that are ours, because the fact that I can't call my own baby, we're not going to get closer to that.
There's always going to be something in the back of our minds going, should we have?
They were going to switch fully in May, but it's only February, and they're like, no, we need to do this. Like, we just need to do this. And
need to live with what happened.
But it's so intense because when they call the next day, it's like Annie's calling Daphne's family and she's like, I think they need to stay, like put. And Daphne's like, oh my God. Like imagine, like it's such a gut punch. It's like, I thought I was going to get my baby back. And then it's like, but it's not your baby.
So they weren't aligned in that?
It's not that they weren't aligned. I think Daphne was like, yes, you're right. But it's still like, imagine it's like still that a like huge panic.
Yeah,
this like panic feeling where you're like, no, I need my... Okay, right. No, you're right. Like, it's, they've been doing this already for a couple of months. this like slow build. In a couple of months, it's like, it's just time now. And it's like important to do it too for the big like sister and the big brother to like, you know?
Yeah.
So they go to this courthouse and they do all the things they're supposed to do. It's so hard. I can't say that enough. The moms will be okay for their kids and like try their hardest and then have like private breakdowns. Alexander, Zoe's biological dad, but had May at the beginning. He's having panic attacks now.
Your child is so hard. Being a new parent is so hard. Again, I don't know it, but the stress you already have about keeping this little baby alive and healthy and well, and then to compound it with the doubt of should we or shouldn't we be doing this massive mm-hmm. switch, this massive change. Like, the amount of guilt, the amount of like, fear, I think every parent knows in some way, shape, or form they're going to mess up at some point in raising mm-hmm. a kid. Like, it's impossible to do something like that perfectly. Mm-hmm. That being said, when this is thrust upon you, so much is out of your control, and that's heartbreaking.
So what I want to say is that like it's amazing what comes to pass, just as far as like the family supporting each other. Daphne calls Annie and is like, Olivia's having a really hard time, like she misses May, and then they just show up at the house, and it's like, wow. No, here's May, let's hang out. And so they start doing a lot of things like that where they're having play dates together and they're spending time together still, even though they've made the switch. And Annie sees May with Olivia. This baby knows this big sister. This baby's happy with this big sister. She shouldn't be deprived of seeing her either. And so then Daphne's like, okay, is this crazy? Should we raise our kids together? Not like buy a big house and all live together, but should we not do a permanent goodbye? Should we not? Maybe the goal shouldn't be totally separating. And everyone feels that. So they start spending a ton of time together. There's struggles. For instance, Zoe, who had lived with Annie,
mm-hmm.
they had been co-sleeping in Annie's bed, but May had been sleeping in a crib. Imagine like she was mothering in a certain way, and now she has a baby that does it differently. So she'll go to sleep on the floor in that room because she doesn't want to be away from May. But she's talking about how she feels she has to become a different person to mother this new child.
Wait, so they did switch? Wait, did I miss that they switched the babies?
Oh, yeah.
I thought you said that she called at February and was like, we can't switch. We have to live with these kids.
No. Opposite. She was like, we absolutely have to switch right now, like if they're ever gonna get used to us.
Okay, I got confused. That's helpful. No. Okay, cool.
They're with their biological children now, but the point is they were being mothers of these other children, and that looked different. So now it's this feeling of like, it's not just that there's a different baby you're learning, it's almost like to be the right kind of parent to that baby, you change who you are. Like you're like, oh, I have to be different. Like it's
yeah.
It's like
you're no longer in control, where you're the parent and you make the decisions. You are now beholden to these patterns of this baby because you're also feeling so guilty about taking them away. And then you're also sitting there going, okay, what were they doing before? And you're adjusting your whole behavior to accommodate this behavior that this, and to be fair, this little baby only knew of.
So then the pandemic happens.
Oh my God.
So they pod. And as a pod, they get really close. These four kids doing everything together now. Olivia and Annie's son are friends, and these babies, and it's these four kids are constantly together, and they're getting counseling and stuff. And this minister, one of the couples is seeing, is like, I have an idea. What if I marry you? Like, as couples, what if we do a weird ceremony that's to honor that these families are joining? And they're like,
okay,
it's weird. We're going to do it. And they do it, which is cute. And there's still obviously constant weird feelings in these families of like missing the babies that they knew and not knowing how to mother these new children. And then I loved that there was this description of a big shift for Daphne when Zoe's 15 months old. Daphne has to leave the house really quick to take out the trash. And when she comes back, she was gone like 2 seconds. She comes back in and Zoe is bawling, like freaked out, and mama, and it like hits her. She realizes that to this kid now, she's just mom. There's not a whole story anymore. Oh, there's no memory of like, this is just mom left and I need mommy. And the simplicity of that, it like changed everything for her, where she was like, I am your mom. It's more simple than I'm making it.
Yeah.
And now they're 5 years old, flash forward.
Oh my gosh.
And they're like besties. They went to the same preschool, and May calls Alexander and Daphne Daddy Xander and Mama Daphne. And and the other kid does the same with Annie and her husband. And they talk a bunch about this to the media. They blow up the clinic, not literally, metaphorically. They settle out of court, so we don't know how much money they got. Obviously, no amount of money is worth what the ordeal that they went through.
No.
But at the same time, it's kind of lovely because in the end, they
got everybody both has more daughters. Parents.
Like, they sort of got two daughters, and now the kids are going to start kindergarten. They're going to separate schools, but because they're going to separate schools, they're like, okay, they're going to do ballet together on Sundays. They are just going to be in each other's lives forever, it feels. And it's really sweet because now, May's first day of school, Annie texts, they're all on a parent text chain where we want to tell you how her first day was.
And sending here's the pictures.
Story. And everybody's like, yes. And May did a drawing in school that was clearly of Daphne. It was a redheaded woman. And Annie was like, oh, what's that drawing? And May's like, it's for you. And she's like, I think it's for Daphne. And she's like, it is. And she's like, okay. And she's, do you want to give it to her in person? And it's a picture of Daphne pregnant with a baby inside her tummy. There are emotional things.
Yeah.
That
well, it sounds
May
like they're not lying or they're
like
not hiding it from the kids as well. The kids probably are all aware of this. You know, no one's hiding what happened.
Yeah. And she's was in that mom's tummy, but this is my mom too.
Those
I just
poor
think
mothers.
It's actually such a beautiful story in the end because
totally.
They did this thing where they get to have both. I don't mean to minimize how difficult it is, but I just think it's really sweet that they went about it in this healing way where they are looking out for everyone and everyone gets more love.
Totally. I think with people who go through IVF, I think everybody, you know, loves their children, of course. But I think too, in this situation, it sounds like these two couples had challenges getting pregnant. Mm-hmm. And so to go through IVF, those kids were really extraordinarily wanted. Like they really had to fight for them. But my heart breaks for these moms who I think it feels like the moms were, I think there's a lot of victims in this, but I think these women who carried these children, obviously that connection you build at that time is so strong. Mm-hmm. And I also think as you have two kids, but like, what works for one kid doesn't work for the other. And there's always doubt. I think it's, you're always like questioning. And so my heart breaks for the beginning of their life that the question wasn't, am I doing enough? The question was, am I doing enough? Am I doing it differently? Am I enough for the amount of additional anxieties with that sounds, it's just so sad.
Yeah.
But I'm so glad. You're totally right. The silver lining is these kids that had two parents, these kids now have four parents. And these older siblings have now, they got three new siblings. It's like, there's something really profoundly beautiful. And I think, thank God everybody was aligned in their goal and put their kids' needs before theirs and their ego and all that stuff. Like so much of that could have gone down another way. And you know what? Communities, man. We need community. That's the lesson there. Do you want me to tell you a story about a mom?
Yeah, why not?
Okay. I got this information from Screen Rant, Why Did You Kill Me? Parade and Reddit.
Whoa. Okay.
So really, really great sources. We are in Riverside, California. It is 8:43 p.m. on February 24th, 2006. 24-year-old Crystal Theobald is going to go with her boyfriend and her brother to 7-Eleven. They're driving in the car and they're actually right behind their mom, Belinda Lane. And she's in the car ahead of them. And so she backs out of the driveway, mom does, and then her kids and her daughter's boyfriend follows behind her. They back out of the driveway, they're driving past, and they see a white SUV pass them and clock them. They reach the end of the street, they see the white SUV suddenly U-turn, drive to the middle of the road, park in front of them. This hooded figure gets out of the car, stands in front of them. They notice he has a gun. Belinda, I think she just goes like, oh, we got to get out of here. So she steps on the gas mm-hmm. and goes forward, and she realizes, she's like, her family is behind her. So she's mm-hmm. like getting out of the way. She turns around. Her family isn't moving. She hears a couple of gunshots. We have security footage at the 7-Eleven 4 minutes later. So 8:47. We have security footage that shows Crystal's boyfriend and brother and Crystal arriving in their car at the 7-Eleven. Her boyfriend runs out right away, goes to 7-Eleven, is yelling at them to get help. We see her brother lift her body out of the car. She is limp in his arms. He brings her body to the storefront. He's distressed. He's cradling her head. It looks like she has been struck in the head at point blank range, while her boyfriend, who's getting help at the 7-Eleven, he was struck in his midsection. They take Crystal to the Riverside Community Hospital, where they try to save her, but 2 days later, she dies. Mm. Her boyfriend undergoes surgery, and he survives. Her brother was not hit. Initially, this area of Riverside, California, is full of a lot of gang activity, and Crystal's family has some ties to drug dealing and gang activity. So initially, the police start investigating her family in the shooting. Her brother has connections to gang-related violence. Her mom had previously served time for selling drugs, and her house is on the territory of the 5150s, which is a gang in Riverside, California. So mm-hmm. what happens is the police get the family in their sight, and we've seen this before where they become hyper-focused on it, and they're not looking for other avenues of what happened. And this mm-hmm. also breeds a lot of distrust in the family. And I think also in these areas where gang violence is strong, I think there is a lot of distrust in the police, right? So there's this sort of like initial distrust between the family and the police force as they're investigating this murder. So one of Crystal's brothers actually has a white SUV, and so he has to be like, it wasn't me. The family believes that some members of the 5150s were held responsible, but Belinda, her mother, is sick of waiting for the police to get their act together, and she has to go set out on her own to find out who did this to her daughter and to catch the murderer. She enlists her young nephew, Crystal's cousin, Jamie, to help her set up a fake profile on MySpace. She chooses MySpace because apparently it was like a pretty big way for a lot of gang members to communicate, and the people that could be suspicious of this murder could often be seen on MySpace. So she enlists her little nephew to set up this MySpace. So she first creates this profile of this girl, Rebecca. She looks online, she finds a photo from Google, and she starts to have conversations with members of the gang. The profile for Rebecca has that she's 17 years old, she loved smoking weed and drinking cervezas, aka beers. And so she made this Rebecca this like party gal. And she realized that profile like wasn't attracting the people she wanted to attract, and it wasn't getting the attention that she wanted. She was like, I need to make a woman who they want to fall in love with and confide in. This woman is in for a good time. She's not creating connections. So she creates a new profile for a girl named Angel. They do say is she modeled Angel after her daughter, Crystal. In fact, she even used Crystal's photo as the profile picture for Angel. She wanted Angel to be this sweet, upbeat, kind person who people wanted to talk to, whereas like Rebecca was always a little bit erratic and a party mm-hmm. animal, like a booty call, and that she was like flirty and would ask them to tell her secrets and was like a little bit like too much, where she was like, you know what, let me model Angel after my daughter. Mm-hmm. And this attracts 17-year-old William Jokes Sotelo. It's April 2006. It's just 2 months after Crystal has been murdered. And William is trying to convince Angel online to come to a party at his house. And so Angel tells him, she's like, hey, I can't get a ride to your house. I don't have a car. Could you pick me up? Mm-hmm. And he's like, yeah, yeah, I can get you. And she's like, what are you driving? And he says, I'm going to drive my white Ford I'm going to drive my white Ford Expedition SUV. So we have the car in question. Mm-hmm. It turns out he also has ties to the 5150s. So as soon as she gets this information, Belinda contacts the police and is like, hey, this guy is a member of the gang. He has the car we're looking for. Can you bring him in for questioning? So the police bring him in for questioning. I think in this area, it sounds like it's interesting reading about this case because compared to other murder, like the idea of having a car and being related feels like it's not enough to bring someone in for questioning. Mm-hmm. But in this area, apparently it is. So after the interrogation, they talk to William and he reveals that he was involved in the shooting, along with Julio Lilhuero Heredia, who fired the gun, William Rasco Lemus, and his brother Manuel Tripper Lemus, and both of them were in the car along with William, Julio, and obviously the Lemus brothers. Mm-hmm. So the story is that the other white SUV, Crystal's brother, who was sitting far away from his mom and Crystal's car, the story they tell is that he fired a couple of shots at them. And so then they wanted to retaliate against her brother. And Crystal just happened to be shot in the crossfire. But that story doesn't add up because when they look at that area, the crime scene, they don't see bullet casings. We have no bullet strikes on William's SUV. No weapons are found in the Theobald household. And so it's just lacking evidence. And so they don't have anything to substantiate that they were fired at mm-hmm. by the Theobald family. So after this account, William is released from custody. He's just allowed to go, even though he says he was a witness and was driving the car. And the police start hunting for the others he accused in the interview. Julio, the shooter, cannot be found. The Lemus brothers are brought in for questioning. The two brothers, Manuel and William Lemus. Manuel doesn't say anything. William is like, hey, we were there. And he tells a similar story to the other William. So both Williams are like fully cooperating with the police. And as you might suspect, these gang members admitting to it and talking to the police is like not a good thing. And I don't think the gang is happy that they're turning on one of their own. The gang starts to retaliate against the Lemus brothers. And so Manuel, who didn't say anything, the gang was like, we know your brother snitched on us and we want to kill you and your brother. I don't think they say that. I think their actions probably spoke enough for them. Okay. And I think, or maybe they were like, we're going to kill your brother. And I think Manuel essentially was like, okay, if you're going after my brother, you're going after me too. I am going to defend my brother more than this gang. And apparently they say to him, what would you do if I killed your brother? Would you be okay with it? And he looked at them and he's like, I would do exactly the same thing as you would do if someone killed your brother. So both Lemus brothers go into hiding. They're like, you know what? All for one, one for all. The 5150 knows where their family lives. And so they actually burn the Lemus family brothers' home in retaliation. And their parents just narrowly escape. The Lemus brothers feel the pressure of this attack from the gang and they decide to turn themselves into the police because they feel like they're like, we can't handle it on our own. We have to get help. They turn themselves in. They essentially become state witnesses for this case in the hopes that they're going to catch the shooter Julio. They are able to identify Julio and the police catch him in Mexico in 2007 because that's where he fled to, and he was able to be extradited back to the U.S. Mm-hmm. The Lemus brothers testify against him at the trial in exchange for immunity. So during the testimony, they allege that the shooting was a result of a mistaken identity. They believe that the group in the SUV believed that Crystal and others inside that car were members of a rival gang, MD-17. So they have these gang members. They have all this evidence against them. They offer Crystal's family, the Theobalds, the opportunity to pursue the death penalty against Julio, the shooter of Crystal. They deny the offer. They say, no, we do not want the death penalty. And in May of 2011, Julio was convicted of first-degree murder for killing Crystal and was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. While he was in custody, he was also convicted of a bunch of other crimes. So in addition to life in prison without the possibility of parole, he has received another sentence of 138 years to life. The initial witness, William Sotelo, after he was released from this first interview, he eluded police for 10 years until he was caught in May of 2016. And once again, Belinda's MySpace had a huge part in his capture. She kept up her posts on social media as Angel. And in 2014, she received a tip that William was in Mexico. And so she forwarded that information to detectives who worked with the FBI and Mexican authorities to track him down and extradite him back to the U.S. In exchange for the prosecution dropping charges of murder and attempted murder and shooting in an occupied vehicle, William just pled guilty to a single charge of voluntary manslaughter. And in 2020, he was sentenced to 22 years in state prison. In 2021, Netflix released the documentary, Why Did You Kill Me? And it details this entire story and Belinda's journey as a mother to find those responsible for killing her daughter. To me, the story is totally just of a mother being like, I have to take actions into my own hand. And if it wasn't for her and her actions on MySpace, who knows if they would have ever found the murderer of Crystal. And I think it also shows so much compassion of who they are that they didn't pursue the death penalty and that they just wanted justice for their daughter and sister and partner. What a sad story. It's horribly sad. And I think it's an incredibly sad story, and it's senseless violence. You know, it had nothing to do. It was just a mistaken identity and how many lives were destroyed because of it. Mm-hmm. Wow. Two stories about moms going hard.
Moms go hard, man. Let it be known. Call your mother.
Call your mother. Call anyone who feels like a mother to you. If I'm just thinking of those who might not have a mother in their life anymore. There's plenty. We got mothers abound.
Yeah. And call me. Maybe.
Call me. Call me maybe. Hey, I just met you. This is crazy. Here's my number. Call your mom. Hey.
Ooh, bless me.
So in case you didn't know, we're on a Snowball, which is our old mic. I'm a little nervous about how it's going to sound, but we'll figure it out.
Let's listen back right now.
Okay. Goodbye, dear readers. We love you.
Happy holidays. And stay safe, stay sane, stay fit, stay fabulous, stay real, stay...
Keep going.